they are partners in these war crimes that the Israelis are committing. Actually, our enemy as Palestinian people is the U.S. and its allies. It's not only the Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Amal, we have heard the Western mainstream media basically just beat the drums of war, claiming that the atrocities that the people in Gaza are facing is on the hands of the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, because they kick-started the Al-Aqsa flood operation to begin with, as if Gaza was in so much peace before the Al-Aqsa flood. How do you debate such accusations?
First of all, the Palestinian resistance actually, what they did is a preemptive operation of Al-Aqsa flood, as their intelligence intercepted information that the Israeli occupation forces are preparing a military operation against Gaza just after their holiday. So what they did is a self-defense. They wanted to defend the Gazan people. They wanted to defend the Palestinians. As you know, the Palestinian people have been living under direct colonial occupation for over a century now, first by the British, then by the Zionists at the moment. So most of the Palestinian refugees who live in 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip were originally forced out of their villages. 55 villages were totally destroyed in Gaza Strip and in Beersheba. So the residents of these refugee camps came from the areas that was forcefully depopulated, displaced. So the international community has to look into the real causes of this war, the real causes of these atrocities. If they only come to a point to recognize the UN Security Council, although we don't believe in it, if they only recognize that, if they only let the refugees back to their villages and their cities, there wouldn't be a need for this war. But of course, the U.S. and its allies want to maintain this military base of colonial apartheid Israel for its own interest, and the Palestinians have to pay the price for it.
Well, Dr. Amal, despite the destruction, we have equally seen undefeated Palestinian will and steadfastness that has amazed the world all across historic Palestine, not only in Gaza during the war. It is truly an astonishment, not only to the friends of Palestine, but also to the enemies of Palestine, especially the Israeli regime itself, and to the Western public opinion who support the Israeli colonial regime as well. How do you explain such a stance when people are facing the horrors that they are seeing in Gaza?
Yeah, it is an astonishment, but we can't be surprised by the Palestinian people who showed resilience and who showed patience and who showed steadfastness all over 75 years of direct Zionist occupation. We can see the women and the children, even the children who have survived the airstrikes of the Israeli F-16s, they are saying that we are not leaving our homes, we are not leaving our land. We did this before in 1948. We were forced out of our homes and our villages, thinking that we will be returning in a week, but we ended up living in refugee camps for 75 years, and that's why we need to stay fast. We need to stay on our land and defend it with our souls. And this is actually surprising for the Israelis, because they thought that if they continue to hit, if they continue their airstrikes against the civilians, they will force them to flee. And even when they told them that there are safe corridors for them to leave to the south, they hit them again with their airstrikes. So the Palestinians know that the only thing that they have is to resist this occupation and steadfast and remain on their lands.
But now Israel is saying that it's opening the corridors of the Rafah border crossing for just 5 hours before it supposedly begins the ground invasion of Gaza. Do you think that even that kind of a red line, if it is crossed by the Zionist entity, will the international community put a stop to it?
No, as I said, the U.S. is leading this international community, and even the U.S. is complicit in this crime. So there is no such thing as peace or secured corridors for the people to leave. We saw that they hit an envoy of cars which were driving to the south. Mm-hmm. And hundreds of people were either killed or injured. So the Israelis actually and the U.S. Well, with its fleet in the Mediterranean just close enough to the Gaza shores are saying the same. Mm-hmm. They don't budge, and they want to continue stressing over and pressuring the Palestinians until they will destroy Hamas. Well, Hamas is not some isolated group from the Palestinian people, not only in Gaza, but in the whole historic Palestine and outside as well. They can't uproot the spirit of resistance from the Palestinian people. They only have two options, either to win and go back to their land, to their homes, which is in occupied 1948, or to continue resistance. There's no other
Dr. Amal Wahdan, our guest from the West Bank Human Rights Advocate, thanks a million for your time and your contribution to our show, specifically at this very extraordinary times in Palestine. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about Zionist missiles that targeted the press right here in South Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, an Israeli artillery strike hit a group of reporters from several outlets who were clearly marked as press. This war crime constituted a blatant attack and a crime against freedom of opinion and the press, human rights, and international humanitarian law through the easy killing of unarmed journalists, victims of their duty to convey the truth, defended with the lenses of their cameras and pens and transfer them to the screens, the repeated Israeli occupation attacks in South Lebanon. Now, let's have more details about this in this following report.
In light of the crazy Israeli ultimatum to 2 million Palestinians in Gaza to move to the south of the Gaza Strip, and the further explosive repercussions it caused militarily and diplomatically, and on the Friday of the general readiness on October 13, in solidarity with the Palestinians in many countries, including Lebanon, the Lebanese press once again paid with blood the tax of covering the truth. At the gradually escalating confrontation lines on the southern Lebanese border with occupied Palestine, journalists were injured by direct and intentional criminal Israeli entity bombing that targeted SNG cars and media crews during their coverage of confrontations that took place in the outskirts of the southern village of Al Mashab. A young journalist, Isam Abdullah, a photographer at Reuters, was killed in the Israeli entity bombing. Two other colleagues, Eli Brachia and Carmen Jukhadar from the Al Jazeera station team, were injured. Also, colleague Christina Asse, a correspondent of AFP, Agence France-Presse, was seriously injured in the feet and hands. And AFP correspondent Dylan Collins was seriously injured. The Iraqi correspondent for Reuters, Thaer Qasim, and his Iraqi colleague, Maher Abdelatif, also suffered injuries and were taken to the Lebanese-Italian hospital in the city of Tyre. This dangerous development appeared to be a warning of the worsening situation on the ground in South Lebanon, such that the press and media became an indiscriminate target for the Israeli occupation, while the confrontation flared up as a result of the bombing of Al Mashab, as the Islamic resistance Hezbollah announced launching attacks on a number of Israeli occupation sites. The Israeli targeting of journalists sparked a wave of angry and widespread union, press, media, and political responses in Lebanon. The targeting of press and media crews came amid a clash that took place in the border area between the towns of Al-Dahira and Al-Mashab in the afternoon, where exchange of fire took place between the Israeli army and Hezbollah in light of violent Israeli bombardment of the area and intense overflights of Apache helicopters. According to the Lebanese army statement, an army intelligence control tower was hit, and the vicinity of Lebanese army and Grain Without Borders centers were bombed, but no casualties were recorded among the ranks of the soldiers. Just as Lebanon, atrocities against the press continued aggressively in Gaza as well, as the Israeli entity continues its most ferocious assault yet on the trapped people of Gaza. It has also targeted journalists' offices, telecommunication networks, and internet services, seemingly to prevent accounts of the mounting atrocities emerging. With these war crimes, the Israeli entity is seeking to silence the Palestinian narrative and erase all traces of its crimes committed against civilians and civilian infrastructure in Gaza. The Zionist Israeli regime wants to close off access to Gaza so that the attention of the Arab world and international public opinion won't be drawn towards the atrocities being committed in terms of war crimes and mass extermination.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ali Awada, journalist and broadcaster at the Lebanese Al Manar channel. Thanks a million for being with us. Dr. Ali, now the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Immigrants instructed the permanent mission of Lebanon to the United Nations in New York to submit a complaint to the UN Security Council about the Israeli entity's deliberate killing of the martyr Issam Abdullah, the Lebanese journalist who worked for Reuters, and the wounding of several other colleagues as well who worked for Agence France Press and Al Jazeera and others as well. Do you believe this move will bring justice to Issam, to his family, to his colleagues?
The Israeli entity must be held accountable. This is the basic rule that all officials in Lebanon have been working on since the first moment reporters and media professionals were exposed to this unprecedented crime against journalists and media professionals. So much so that a team is directly exposed to this crime by the Zionist entity. The Israeli entity targeted them even though it knew for certain that these were journalists. This is a crime that will not be tolerated. This was confirmed by the chairman of the Media and Communications Committee, member of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, MP Dr. Ibrahim al-Mousawi. From the first moment of this crime, Dr. Mousawi had a clear position, which was that Lebanon would not remain silent about this crime. And from that moment, this file was transferred. The Lebanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs was addressed to activate this file at the international level. The axis of resistance working on these files must make every effort required to be able to prosecute the Zionist enemy for this crime and other crimes it committed. In answer to your question, yes, there is a real effort being made by those concerned, including the Parliamentary Information Committee, which is making every effort with serious contacts made at the level of human rights associations in a number of European countries to activate this file. Because what happened is a crime in every sense of the word, and no one can cover it up. This is a crime because there were eyewitnesses who were present on the ground, and all data confirmed that the Zionist enemy was the one who committed this crime. Therefore, yes, I believe this time is unlike all the times. The Zionist enemy will be prosecuted for the crime it committed, but as for the nature of this prosecution, we will see where the path of justice will reach in it so that conclusions can be derived from.
Well, Dr. Ali, in an attempt to basically just silence the truth, the Israeli entity keeps assaulting the media and the press, whether in Lebanon, in Palestine, in a bid to control the narrative that comes out of both countries. How do you think this makes those who work in the media feel while covering the live events as they unfold, especially in a war zone? And how much do you think it affects their efforts to deliver basically the truth to the public? Are they afraid to do their work now?
What the Zionist enemy is doing and what it has done towards the late photographer Mara Issam Abdullah will increase journalists' determination to convey the truth. This is what we saw in the Al-Mashab area on the Lebanese-Palestinian border. It is true that press crews were targeted, but at the same time, the Arab local and cable channels were reporting what happened, and the reporters completed covering what the Zionist enemy was doing. There was a real attempt by the enemy to obscure the truth, especially since it was targeting Lebanese border areas. The enemy wanted to silence these media professionals, but the response was resounding when these reporters insisted on completing media coverage at the location of the crime, provided that they returned to the live broadcast again. This indicates one fact, that all these crimes, such as the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh, whose memory is still fresh until this moment from May 2022, when she fell as a martyr. Yet this never silenced the voice of the truth, nor did it prevent reporters and media professionals from continuing to convey the truth to the whole world. The enemy wants to obscure this truth, but on the other hand, a group of reporters will always be on the lookout to defend the true story as it is in Gaza. In Gaza, we daily see the crimes committed by the enemy against the Palestinian people. What if there were no media that possessed conscience, freedom, and sanctified the truth? Then wouldn't that truth be threatened and lost? So the will still persists amongst Lebanese journalists and wherever there are media outlets that have a free and honest conscience in this world.
Definitely, I hear you very well, Dr. Ali, but something really interesting, let me say, not to say another word, happened after the targeted killing of Isam Abdullah, the Lebanese journalist. We saw that there was blind bias and international and deliberate ignorance, if you will, of the international agency Reuters and a number of international media outlets who deliberately refrained from naming the side that killed Isam and injured his friends as well. I mean, why would they do that? Why? How would you assess that the company, the media organization that Isam works with, actually deliberately dropped the people who committed the crime?
In fact, this bias was surprising. We always read that these media institutions are distinguished by their long history and that they are supposed to protect democracy and freedom, especially freedom of opinion and expression. But in fact, this is a failure that history will record regarding the extent of the media institution's commitment to objectivity. Why? Because everyone was present and could see who bombed these media professionals. Therefore, this media institution was supposed to report the story as it is, without defending any party. It should have named the party that attacked the martyr Isam Abdullah and the team present with him. This is a media misstep that will go down in history. But we know that in all the wars that took place over the past years, there were some media institutions run by Western parties that were somewhat sympathetic to the Zionist enemy. In addition, there is a lot of information and studies that clearly indicate that those who manage these institutions in administrative positions, especially the boards of directors, belong ideologically and intellectually to the Zionist enemy. Somewhat, this topic is neither surprising nor new. As we know, in all previous wars, whether in the July 2006 war or the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, there were many media institutions that adopted the framing technique in the process of covering events. In any case, this reality exists in most wars, where attempts are made to obscure the truth, to exonerate the oppressor and the murderer, and to attempt to hide the truth. However, public opinion remains much more aware, especially since we are in the era of social media and the reality of live feed broadcasting, which can distinguish between truth and falsehood, and there are always conscious professionals to follow the path of the truth.
I second your opinion here, Dr. Ali, concerning that, and the truth shall always be out there, because there are a lot of people who care for Palestine and who care for Lebanon and will always tell the truth. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ali Awada from Beirut, journalist and broadcaster at the Lebanese Al-Manar Channel, for joining us to talk about the atrocities that befell, actually, Lebanon, the martyrdom of our own Isam Abdullah, the Lebanese journalist who was killed by the Zionist entity, and his friends were injured right there when the whole world was seeing, just as the whole world was seeing how Gaza as well was being basically just under genocide by the Israeli entity. But we are always here. We are always going to remember every martyr that fell. We are always going to talk about the wounds of every one of our native Levantinians, and especially against the Israeli entity. And we are always here to give voice to the voiceless. Ladies and gents, we'll see you again next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New figures show that one in four working parents in London, England, are struggling to feed their families due to the cost of living crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsletter The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. An influential group of economists said the United Kingdom's economy is in a horrible fiscal bind as it heads for recession with no room to cut taxes or increase public spending to offer a boost. The Institute for Fiscal Studies warned that Britain will slump into a moderate recession in the first half of 2024 as the struggle for growth remains while borrowing costs stay elevated. It comes as the Bank of England's chief economist warned that there was still work to do to bring Britain's inflation back under control, a hint that the base interest rate could rise yet again. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was little room for the tax cuts wanted by Tory MPs anytime soon in its green budget assessment of the nation's public finances ahead of Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt's autumn statement. Using analysis by Citi, the Institute for Fiscal Studies report warned that Britain would fall into recession at the start of 2024 that will last for 9 months. It also forecast the gross domestic product, GDP, would slump by 0.7% next year. Paul Johnson, the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, said, "We are in a horrible fiscal bind. The price of our high levels of indebtedness, failure to stimulate growth, and high borrowing costs is likely to be a protracted period of high taxes and tight spending." The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was no room for tax cuts or spending hikes despite a six-year freeze on income tax thresholds would mean an extra £52 billion a year by 2027. The equivalent of raising the basic and higher rate of income tax by 6 pence. Paul Johnson said the amount raised by the fiscal drag process pushes people into higher income tax brackets as pay increases was extraordinary. The Labour Party said the so-called stealth tax rise showed that the Tories had crashed the economy. Darren Jones, the shadow chief treasury secretary, said successive failures by Conservative ministers have left us with low growth, high tax and national debt at the highest level in generations. The Institute for Fiscal Studies cautioned Rishi Sunak's government could come under pressure to increase public spending by more than planned, as it offered a stark assessment of the situation a Labour government faces if it wins the 2024 general election. The report said beyond March of 2025, there are likely to be real-term cuts to the day-to-day budgets of many governmental departments and falling spending on investment in public services. It comes despite growing pressure to improve services such as the National Health Service and to commit to spending in areas such as defence and childcare. London Evening Standard has also covered the same story and tells us more. British government borrowing is said to be around £20 billion lower this year than the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, predicted in March. But debt levels have soared as borrowing costs have gone up and the inflation rate remains above target. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said that interest rates are set to remain above 5% until mid-2024, when the Bank of England could begin steadily cutting interest rates. But the bank faces its own challenge of bringing down inflation whilst avoiding a deeper recession, which could be worsened by higher interest rates. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the Monetary Policy Committee may want to wait for firm evidence of disinflation before it considers cutting interest rates. But by that point, it might be too late, and the result could be a deep recession. The central bank's chief economist, Hugh Peel, said on Monday, 16th of October, that there was more work to do to fight inflation, in a hint that the base rate could rise again from its current level of 5.25%. Hugh Peel said, "We'll still have some work to do in order to get back to the inflation target of 2%. And we probably have some work to do to ensure that when we get back to 2%, we do so in a way that is sustainable through time." Benjamin Nabarro, the chief UK economist at Citibank, said, "The lesson of the 1970s was to hold rates tight until you can see the whites in the eyes of disinflation. In a highly financialized, debt-driven economy, that may turn out to be the only half the story. The government claimed it was on track to get debt falling and that it would not be deterred by changes to economic growth, inflation and interest rates. It added, to secure our public finances, we must stick to our plan, which is on track to halve inflation, reduce public sector waste and get debt falling." The Metro newspaper has also covered the same story and tells us more. New figures showed one in four working parents in London are struggling to feed their families due to the cost of living crisis. Food charity The Felix Project has surveyed more than 2,000 working parents in the capital London, with a quarter saying they skipped meals or didn't buy food for themselves so their children could eat. Research also suggests 11% of London's working families have less than £3 a day to spend on food. It comes as inflation rates have hit an all-time high in recent months and millions of families are struggling across the United Kingdom due to an increased cost of living. The charity said 14% of respondents have turned to a food support service like a food bank for the first time in the last year. Families have told how food sharing apps have helped during these tough times, and it is one of the reasons why earlier this year, Metro launched its Formula for Change campaign series in partnership with the charity Feed. Shane Dorset, Director of Operations at the Felix Project, says many people would be very surprised at the kinds of people struggling. Shane Dorset added, "People who have never used food service organisations before are these days showing up." He said people who go to work every day, sometimes they have more than one job, are now using food banks. The Felix Project's chief executive officer, Charlotte Hill, said, "There is a huge demand for food support services, which emphasizes the dire need among working families." Charlotte Hill added, "Every single one of the charities we support wants more food, and there are over 650 new organisations on our waiting list that we cannot help."
we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Facing rising rents and economic insecurity, many American families live doubled up in extended households. Recession and high unemployment rates are associated with more doubling up. Households are considered doubled up if they contain any adults besides the householder and her romantic partner. For students, living doubled up can be a headache. Research shows living doubled up in a crowded condition increases panic attacks in class, chronic hunger, sleep deprivation, and unmet medical or psychological needs. Many students are runaways from doubled-up situations because the atmosphere has become insufferable. Living doubled up. American adults are increasingly sharing a home with other adults with whom they're not romantically involved. This arrangement, known as doubling up or shared living, is increasing in the country. Doubling up is associated with economic disadvantage. Both householders and guests in doubled up households are more likely to have poverty level personal incomes than non-doubled up adults. There are, of course, other reasons associated with this social phenomenon, but most agree that economic issues top the list.
It's pretty clearly a result of economic conditions under which it's very difficult for many people to afford housing. I mean, if you're living with, if you're living with your friends or living with extended family because you want to, that's great. But I think in far too many cases, rent is simply unaffordable. The idea of people buying their own homes is just out of the question.
But just how many people do own a home in America? Statistics show over 65% of Americans own a home as of 2022. Some 74 million Americans, or about 27%, live in a condo or properties by homeowners associations, and 58% of housing units were owner-occupied.
My actual job is I'm a computer programmer.
Okay.
I have an allergy against paying 10% of my paycheck or more for rent. And this is where my dirty clothes go, and then I have a giant bag of film.
So do you mind being in a pod?
No, I sleep here. It's like a place where I sleep and an apartment that comes with its own friends. I've already had my permanent life. I was married. I have kids. The kid is all the way through college.
Yeah.
I'm here because my job is here, but it's too expensive to rent my own place.
What would be the price if you wanted an apartment? What would
be one bedroom in this area would be $4,000, $5,000.
What do you pay for a pod?
About $1,200. We have a pretty nice common space.
Yeah. Do you have your own?
These two. And you get a section in the refrigerator. Bathroom is there. The job I have right now is the most high-paying job I've ever had in my life. And I can't afford a $5,000 a month apartment.
Millennials, America's largest generation, are becoming homeowners later in life and at lower rates than the generations of Americans that preceded them. Along with carrying expensive student loans, millennials are choosing to rent for longer in locations that tend to be more expensive. The Urban Institute found that nearly half of households headed by people 18 to 34 years old were rent-burdened meaning that they're paying upwards of 30% of their paycheck just to cover rent.
You know, the idea of having roommates in modern America is very common. primarily, most of my adult life, I've always lived with roommates, and it's always been a financial reason. I think a lot of younger people in America are not in a position to afford their own housing or even afford their own apartment. You know, so I think that the trend of people living together is 100% economic. You know, I think there are some people who choose to do that out of loneliness reasons, but I definitely feel like it's 100% financial and economic.
The rise in shared living is likely not simply a response to rising housing costs and weak incomes. A recent article by the Washington Post says that while families with children taking on roommates is fairly rare, it may be part of a broader trend toward more multi-generational living. In other words, some families do this just to create a sense of community in the household.
I think that you could say that there are cultural factors at play insofar as, you know, many people, you know, feel lonely and alienated, and that might, you know, have some appeal for them. But honestly, I really don't think that that is the main thing going on here. I think that is almost certainly going to be mostly economic. That, in other words, we're primarily talking about a phenomenon that's going on among people who, who can't just, buy their own homes or just pay whatever rent, they please.
The increase in doubling up is offsetting other social trends bearing on the nature of the nation's households and demand for housing. While Americans are less likely to be living with a spouse or unmarried partner in their household, the rise in doubling up means more adults are living with non-relatives and with relatives other than romantic partners. As a result, the average number of adults per household has not declined since 1995, and consequently, the number of households per adult has not increased.
In a shared living environment, obviously you want to share a living space with people who you get along with, who you have, similarities with, who you can get along with. And so having similar cultural traits is probably ideal. But, I definitely look for roommates who I share common interests with and things like that. So, I think that – but primarily it is driven by – financial factors and in order to pay the bills, because the prices of housing here is pretty extreme these days, and so I think most people are forced into a shared living situation.
The Washington Post article says living with others is much more common in other parts of the world, such as Western Europe, where there's a less of a cultural emphasis on privacy. Having privacy seems to be more of an American issue. But how much of this living doubled up is really driven by that factor?
I'd say here in America, like, loneliness is a different concept. I think a lot of people in America want to be left alone these days. I think people in America are very comfortable just being on their cell phones and not being bothered by the outside world. I mean, that's my impression. And, maybe that's not true for everybody. Of course it's not true for everybody, but as a broad generalization, I feel like most and even younger people, they love to just be left alone. They don't want to be impeded on by other people, and especially after the COVID lockdown era, I think that drove people even further into isolation, and people are very comfortable in their isolation here in the United States. You don't see multiple generation families living in the same household. You definitely see a larger emphasis on privacy here. So again, I feel like just the choice to live with other people, like in the same house, is, again, just driven by economics.
Many families' budgets are squeezed amid ongoing inflation. Having renters provides a meaningful source of income for many families, allowing them to work fewer paid hours and devote more time to caregiving. The decision is about more than just savings, though. It could enhance family life.
The big question that I would ask is, if this is something that's happening more now, what changed? And if there is a greater cultural emphasis in the United States than in some other countries on privacy, that could well be true, but then the issue would be, well, why would that suddenly change now? And that's a little bit harder to understand, whereas the rent going up and people having more trouble paying it is all too easy to understand.
Almost 600,000 people are homeless in America. That's a staggering number for the world's leading economy. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, 7 million extremely low income renters cannot get affordable housing. This is not because of a lack of funding, is it? Because the U.S. spends well over $700 billion on defense, not to mention the Ukraine aid.
When you see people living on the street, you could say they're alcoholic, they're drug addicts, they're schizophrenic. There's all the long list of reasons why they're living on the street. But how do they stop living on the street, right? And how many of them started out being hardworking, decent, normal people who are trying to pay all their bills on a minimum wage salary when the price of the real estate just kept going up exponentially?
I am a very, very staunch, fierce opponent of spending $700 billion on the military just to go around the world and murder people. Like that, like you have no idea. That angers me. You know, all of this money being sent to Ukraine, that angers me as an American. Like it's infuriating. You know, it very much is infuriating that America has to have their hands all over the world creating conflict. And what we're seeing with Ukraine is it's a money laundering operation. It's just horrific. And I wish that changes someday, you know. My government, my United States, and this is what I want to tell, United States government does not represent me as an American. I'm a proud American. I love America. I love America institutions. But this government that is here in the United States is evil and wrong. And I hope that someday something changes.
Statistics on the number of homeless youth in the U.S. fails to tell the entire story because so many young people do not fit the strict definition of homeless. For example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development defines homeless people as those who are living in shelters, in transitional housing, or outdoors. This definition fails to account for the many children or young adults who go from place to place, couch surfing as it's called, with friends and relatives, or pay for short stays at motels.
I just moved here. I've only been here about 3 weeks.
Are you looking for work? Are you traveling?
I'm looking for work, yeah.
In what?
Tech.
And so rents are too much?
Well, yeah, obviously. I don't have a job yet.
Part of the issue with homelessness in America is, yes, you do have a lot of mental health issues, but you also have, even in addition to the mental health, you have 98% of the people there that are homeless are on hard drugs, like heroin, meth, alcohol. And so until we address the drug and alcohol problem, you're going to have homelessness. And here in the United States, you know, until we reform the drug laws, until we reform some of the ways that we handle drugs and the prison system, I think that that's going to continue to be a problem here in the United States.
Homelessness has become a particularly bad political problem for big cities, where it is most visible. In many big cities, homelessness has become criminalized even. This is because big corporations in the housing market know that having homeless people wandering about a neighborhood spells trouble for the business.
At nighttime, even with the blankets and stuff like that down here, you still be freezing. This concrete gets so cold it cracks. Since I've been out here about 7 years, I've seen about about six people down here passed away.
If Fred can't help me, I go stay on the train. You know, back and forth. Then I started the day all over again. You see my buggy all broke down like I'm broke down now.
Continue to be a problem here in the United States. And then also they use homelessness as a tool, a political tool. So in certain cities like Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, they allow homelessness and they use it as a way to, like, I think it's like a form of terrorism, honestly. It's a way to terrorize a community, drop property value. You know, and so all these areas with massive homelessness, they're going to drop the property value. The banks will come in, they'll buy that property up, and then fast forward 20 years and it'll be a nice neighborhood and they'll make lots of money. So I believe homelessness is being used as a weapon. And I think that the poor people that are homeless, you know, honestly, they don't want anything different. They know, especially in a place like LA, like they know that there's help available, but they would rather spend their lives high and drunk.
Racial minorities experience homelessness at a disproportionate rate. For example, Black or African Americans make up 13% of the general population, but 40% of the homeless population. Young Black people have also an 83% higher risk of becoming homeless than their white counterparts.
I think it's pretty clearly a result of the past history of racial discrimination that, you know, the United States was in many ways an apartheid country up until the 1960s, at least in large parts of the country, had official legal discrimination on the basis of race. And even though that's ended, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be intergenerational consequences. If people are born into poverty, they're more willing, they're much more likely to die in poverty than people who weren't born into poverty. And that's going to be true of people of any racial background. But of course, the long-term effects of Jim Crow, of that system of racial segregation, are going to mean that those effects are distributed differently. But the real point I would emphasize about this is that while the racial disparity definitely shows that, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, meritocracy or hard work or something, that these are factors beyond people's control, the goal, as people like, you know, my friend Adolf Reed, you know, would always say, the goal shouldn't be to have a society where we have exactly proportionally distributed wealth and poverty. The goal should be a vastly more economically equal society. I mean, it's not that the problem is that we have, you know, a disproportionate number of Black people as opposed to white people sleeping in the streets. It's that in a reasonable society, no one would be sleeping in the streets.
The overrepresentation of Black and Native Americans in the homeless population is no accident. It is a result of historic and ongoing racism, from slavery and violent land theft to informal and government-backed housing discrimination that persists even till this very day. Research shows that because of these massive burdens, people of color, particularly Black and Native Americans, are more likely to experience poverty and other vulnerabilities that place people at risk of homelessness.
It's really sad. I believe that now is there's never been a better time than ever in the history of the world for a minority in America to rise up and make an amazing life for themselves. But I feel like there's certain communities and certain cultures that are told from a young age that you will never be anything because of the color of your skin. You will never be anything because this group over here is oppressing you. You are the oppressed. You are the oppressed. They are the oppressors. And I feel like the Black community, unfortunately, has been victims of that messaging so long that maybe some of them believe it. My message would be, no, you're not a victim. You're not oppressed. There's nothing wrong with you because of the color of your skin. Get out there and get it. Crush. It's amazing. It's a beautiful thing, you know, and it's interesting because I feel like in America, that is what the leftist, progressive, liberal mentality wants to tell the Black communities, that you are oppressed. You are less than because of the color of your skin. You will never amount to anything. And that's a horrible way. And so I feel like a lot of people fall into that victim mentality.
But economic and social vulnerabilities don't tell the entire story. Data shows the poverty alone does not account for the disproportionate representation of Black Americans experiencing homelessness, for example. The homeless response system, which triages, supports, and rehouses people experiencing homelessness, has not been designed to identify or respond to racial disparities.
They fall into the other cultural programming that comes through the Black community, which is like rap music, drug culture, gangster culture, violence. These things are perpetuated in that community, and it's hard for anybody to rise up out of it. But no, you're not a victim. You don't have to commit crime. You can thrive. And I know being a white man saying these things, it may be construed as insensitive because, yes, I know that that's very hard living in an impoverished community, lack of resources, lack of healthy food. I know all this stuff to be true. But still, there's ways to rise above, and there's never been a better time than now to do it. So my heart goes out absolutely to anybody that's suffering with homelessness, drug addiction. And then once you get caught up in the system, again, I know you could also make the same claim about how the African-American population is disproportionately represented in the prison system. And so, you know, I think it goes back to drug laws, too. Once the drug laws get reformed, then you don't have so many Black people getting harassed by the police, and then you don't have so many people getting caught up in the system, and then you don't have so many, like, violent shootings. And so it kind of stems from a lot of these core issues. But, I just feel like, yes, there's probably an overrepresentation of African-Americans, both in the prison and homeless population.
The political debate in the U.S. seems to be in a state of partisan deadlock. Democrats and Republicans seem to be in a constant state of fighting over small and big issues facing the country. This political rivalry, of course, has its toll on the lives of Americans.
Here in the United States, you have the progressive left Democrats, you have the hard conservative right, conservatives, you know, trying to both push equally opposing stories. I don't subscribe to any of it. I'm outside of both. I can sit back and I can watch both of them fighting with each other and be like, well, that's cute. That's hilarious. I can get some entertainment out of it. But ultimately, I don't think that that these politics or political debates will bear any fruit. And it's only designed to keep us fighting with each other. But I think, again, like with the homeless issue, again, I believe that that is used as a political football, is what we call it, like a political tool that's kicked back and forth to get votes or support one way or the other. You know, it's like they use people to their advantage. And that's one of the most deplorable, awful things about politics, is that people don't mean anything. They're just whether they're being sent off to war to die, or if they're just being, you know, used as political props with, you know, homelessness or just whatever. You know, politicians don't care about anybody, and they just care about their own power and wealth, really.
Indeed, severe polarization makes democracy vulnerable. In healthy democracies, opposing sides are seen as political adversaries to compete against and at times negotiate with one another. In deeply polarized democracies, though, the other side comes to be seen as an enemy needing to be vanquished. In this tribal dynamic, each side views the other outgroup party with increasing distrust, bias, and enmity. Perceptions that if you win, I lose grow. The problem with this pervasive atmosphere is that problems like affordable housing and homelessness do not get solved.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
In the United States, Judge Tanya Chutkan has said Donald Trump's presidential candidacy does not give him carte blanche to vilify public servants who are simply doing their job. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The federal judge overseeing the case against former President Donald Trump relating to the 2020 election agreed on Monday, 16th of October, to impose some limitations on what he can say publicly about the case, restricting the former president and his attorneys from making inflammatory statements targeting Special Counsel Jack Smith and his staff, court personnel, and possible witnesses who may testify in the proceedings. The decision from the U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan followed a lengthy hearing in federal court in Washington, D.C., regarding a request from Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team to limit what Donald Trump can say about the case brought against him by the Justice Department. Judge Tanya Chutkan issued a split ruling granting the Justice Department's request for restrictions on the specific statements by the former president that she said could jeopardize the trial. This is not about whether I like the language Mr. Trump uses. This is about language that presents a danger to the administration of justice, the judge said. Donald Trump posted on Truth Social that he will appeal the decision. Judge Tanya Chutkan denied Special Counsel Jack Smith's request to prohibit the president from making statements about the District of Columbia, where a trial set for March of 2024 is scheduled to be held, or criticizing the Biden administration or the Justice Department. Donald Trump has accused the Special Counsel of pursuing a politically motivated prosecution designed to harm his campaign against President Biden in the 2024 presidential race. First Amendment protections yield to the administration of justice and the protection of witnesses, Judge Chutkan said on Monday, 16th of October. In a statement, a Trump spokesperson called the decision an absolute abomination and another partisan knife struck in the heart of our democracy. President Trump will continue to fight for our Constitution, the American people's right to support him, and to keep our country free from the chains of weaponized and targeted law enforcement, the spokesperson for Trump said. During the at times contentious court hearing on Monday, 16th of October, where allegations of threats and political censorship abounded, attorneys and Judge Tanya Chutkan herself grappled with the potential consequences of either taking action to limit Trump's public statements or keeping the current conditions of his pretrial release in place. Prosecutors asked Judge Tanya Chutkan last month to impose what they described as a narrowly tailored order to prevent the former president from making extrajudicial statements that present a serious and substantial danger of materially prejudicing the case. Citing numerous tweets and other public statements, the special counsel, Jack Smith, argued that Trump has an established practice of targeting those who challenge him, which they said could damage the fair trial process. Donald Trump, they alleged on Monday, was trying the case in the court of public opinion. His attorneys opposed the request, claiming any court order would restrict his right to free speech and hinder his ability to campaign because the criminal prosecution and the issues it raises are intertwined with the political campaign.